our speaker for tonight, I've known him for about over 22 years. And we met here in Harris Hall, the building just across that way. I believe it's still standing. I could be wrong, but this building was not here. And I can't tell you enough about his character, and just a very humble man that has taught me a lot over the years, and had the privilege of having him at my wedding too, which was really nice. Him and his lovely wife. So I know I will get a treat out of tonight, and I know you will too. And please join me in welcoming our speaker, Jack C.
I'm a grateful, enthusiastic, and very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Jack Carpenter. Pat, thanks for inviting me to talk. You know, I get the privilege of doing this quite a bit. I travel around the country, and I get to go to conferences in other places and other countries, actually. And the hardest thing you'll ever do is talk at your home group. There's nobody more intimidating than your home group when you think you're a big deal speaker out on the road. This is scary right here. I want to say happy birthday to the birthday people, Fernando and Roger, a couple of guys that have asked to walk the path with me. We stay in regular touch, and I grow more from them than I think they do from me, but don't tell them, they don't know. Whenever they're thinking of doing something silly, my voice is in their head. I feel really bad about that. I was listening to a tape on the way over here, a talk that Lois Wilson did in 1969. It was about a year and a half before her husband Bill passed away. And they asked her to talk about some of the early history of Al-Anon, which I've been fascinated with for many years. Just to establish my credentials, I showed up at my first Al-Anon meeting in February the 19th of 1990. I got here with a wife at home who was already sober. I didn't like her. And I went to Al-Anon and found out it was just me and the girls. I liked the girls. The girls was fine. I figured if it doesn't work out at home, I've always got the fallback plan here, and they were treating me special. But didn't you ever wonder when you were new how they knew about you? When they read the stuff out of the literature, when somebody shares at the meeting, they're sharing secrets that I'm carrying around and I've never shared with anybody on the planet. Did you wonder how they knew? And I found out through a bunch of research going way back in history about how Bill and Lois Wilson, Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Lois Wilson, his wife, the founder of Al-Anon, how they had their first, they knew each other, but the first kind of a date that they had. And here's how it happened. Bill used to watch Lois. They were up on Emerald Lake in Vermont, and Lois was among the summer people. She was family, had money. Daddy was a doctor. And every single day, Lois would go out on Emerald Lake in her little sailboat, her little Valley Girl sailboat, and she'd sail all around the lake, and Bill watched her, and he decided he wanted to meet her. So he decided he couldn't afford a little sailboat, so he got himself a rowboat, and he rigged up a mast on it, probably out of an oar standing on end, and he hung a blanket from it and tied it off to the side. And then he went out on the lake before Lois started her little sail in the morning, and he hid in a little bay, and he waited for her. And along comes Lois, and she's skipping along the waves in her little sailboat, and Bill pounces, comes out of the little bay that he's in, and falls in beside her for a race. And Lois looks over at him and pulls the rope on her little skiff and tightens the sail and skips away. Whereupon Bill promptly capsized his craft and wound up in the lake. And Lois was forced to turn around and go back and rescue him from the lake. Their first date. This is how they know about all of our stuff. This is how they know. I got here. I come from a family that shot through with alcoholism. I didn't know what it was. It's everywhere. It's like a fish underwater. Does the fish know there's water? No, the fish don't know there's water. There's just where I am. Alcoholism in every direction except for my parents. Brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. I believe it's been killing my family for generations. I've done a bunch of research into my genealogy now, into DNA research and all that stuff to try and track my family back. And I have a rich history of alcoholics going back to battles in Europe and world wars. Wars and all kinds of stuff, a long, rich history. I had no idea what I was up against until I met my beautiful wife, Leslie, who is sitting right here in the front row. Wave your hand at him, baby. I had no idea what I had gotten a hold of until I got a hold of that. But we found out what alcoholism was right after that. And if she doesn't break out in a drunk in the next 3 weeks, 3 weeks from tomorrow, she'll have 35 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm reasonably certain I didn't have anything to do with that, although you couldn't have convinced me that in the early days. When she had a year of sobriety, she invited me to go with her to an open AA meeting. It was an AA speaker meeting over in the Valley. It was Mason Lassen. I still remember the speaker, the lady, she's not with us anymore. Her name was Dorothy Scott. And Dorothy was pissed off because Dorothy was an identical twin. And she was an alcoholic and had to go to AA and couldn't drink anymore. And her identical same DNA twin was not an alcoholic. She hated her sister because she could drink if she wanted to. And the other half of her talk, she did talking about her Al-Anon husband, Jerry. And I remember, this is my first meeting of any kind. I've never been to an Al-Anon meeting, never been to an AA meeting. And she's saying all these things about how much she hated her husband, Jerry. And then she said, and I remember the moment that it changed. She said, I was sitting in the living room and I saw him through the kitchen door, puttering around in the kitchen. And a thought came to my mind. I thought, you know, the little son of a bitch is kind of cute. It was her turning point, right? I still believe that that was over 33 years ago, almost 34 years ago now. It was 34 years ago this month, actually. I think she was there to talk to me. I don't know if she was speaking to anybody else in the room, but she was talking to me. And I thought that I'd gone to that meeting to give her a cake because I'd earned the right by helping her get sober. And I realize now after long exposure that I never had that kind of power to help her. My wife got sober in spite of me. She didn't get sober because of my help. My wife got sober because she was going to die of her alcoholism, and I was an impediment to her sobriety. I will tell you that in the earliest days of our, well, let me, I'm going to jump around a little bit. I'm going to back up. I was previously married. I'm a Vietnam era veteran, United States Marine Corps. I did not see combat. Thank you very much. My brother did. We lost him about 2 years ago to this disease, I believe. He was never able to get right after he came home from Vietnam. He had various periods of sobriety and just couldn't stick with it. And I was married and I'd come out of the service and trying to work a little job as beginning in my career in the movie industry. And my then wife was working days at a hardware store, keeping the books, and a babysitter was at our house watching our children, a little boy and a little girl. They were 1 and 3. And an accident happened, and my little one-year-old girl drowned in the backyard in a foot and a half deep kiddie pool. It was one of those ones you could go to the Save-On drugstore and buy it for $20 or something. It was about that deep, and she was out there unattended, and she drowned while the babysitter was in the house watching TV or talking on the phone. And the paramedics came. It was a big mess. I got the call on. I was on a set. They came and got me and took me to the hospital. And she basically died in the pool. They revived her. And she was in Children's Hospital for about 6 weeks on a respirator. She had a trach tube. She had a feeding tube in her stomach. And at the end of 6 weeks, they announced that they were going to send her off to a state hospital. Children's Hospital did not, I don't think they believed that she was going to get better, and they were just going to send her to, they were going to warehouse her. My former wife, I believe, was the adult child of an alcoholic parent. I know that she was because I knew her dad. And she said, no way, the kid's not going to that hospital. We'll take her home. We'll take care of her. And she volunteered us to bring that little girl home and take care of a profoundly comatose child in our little tiny house down in San Fernando, about 900 square feet with a flat roof on it. And we're both struggling to make ends meet and keep medical insurance and all that stuff. Little girl, she lived for a year in our house in a crib by my side of the bed, and then she passed away. And again, I was away at work. I got the call, there's been an accident or there's been a problem. And 2 minutes left. Thanks for asking me to talk tonight. There's a lot of relief I can feel in the room, emanating in the room. anyway, she passed away after a year. They came and got me on the set again. They called me and said there's been an emergency. And I took a very hot run up Devonshire Boulevard just before the 118 freeway was there. It's 1977, trying to get to the hospital. Like, my being there would make a difference. And a couple of things happened there that are important, and I talked about them for a specific reason. One of them is that by the time I got to the hospital, my whole family was at the hospital. I got a big family. We do everything together. Alcoholism is a main player there, but everything we do as a unit. We're all sick together. We're just sick in a bigger group. And I remember pulling out in front of the hospital, and my dad was standing out in front. My dad was a rough, tough old cowboy, a stuntman, a motorcycle gang guy when he'd been a kid, a truck driver. He was just that guy. He was standing out in front of the hospital waiting, and I got out of the car. As I walked up to him, he turned without a word and walked into the hospital, so I followed him. We went to the elevator. He pushed the button. We went up to the second floor at Holy Cross Hospital. We got out, and we started down the hallway. I'm still following him. He still hasn't said a word. And we walked past the door where my family was in the family room waiting. And as I went by the door, I looked in, and I saw all of my brothers and sisters. My then wife was in there. The rest of my family was in there. There was a big gathering of us. And we went past that door. We continued straight down the hall. And at the end of the hall, the last door on the left, we turned in, and I walked into the room behind my father to find my little two-year-old girl laying dead on a stainless steel table without so much as a blanket, to find out that she had died. Now, feelings are not big currency in a family like mine. We didn't sit around a campfire poking the coals saying, "I'm feeling frightened today." We didn't talk about that stuff. Fear was unacceptable. I learned early on and perfected it before I got to you, this weird alchemy of alcoholism where I could take fear and turn it into anger. Fear was unacceptable. Fear was embarrassment. Fear was something to be cataloged and weaponized by my family. Anger seemed to be acceptable, so I would go straight to anger instead of the fear. I had no idea until I did an inventory with a sponsor that underlying all of that fear, all of that anger bordering on rage, was fear. I had no idea. And I walked in that room and saw that little girl on the table, and I burst out crying for about 30 seconds. And I hated my dad for seeing it, because it was a weakness, and weaknesses did not go unpunished in a family like mine. And I hated him for walking me in there, because he knew when he met me in the parking lot, she was already dead, and he didn't tell me. I hated him for years for that. When I came through the doors of Al-Anon, my biggest resentment and my biggest fear were around him. I was angry at him for that, because I couldn't do anything with the shame that was attached to it. And I was afraid that as the oldest child, when he died, I'd have to do his eulogy. And I was going to tell you all what a rotten son of a bitch he was. I was legitimately afraid that I was going to get up here and just tell all them people what he really was. And that did not happen. I wound up doing my dad's eulogy years later, but I did it with the benefits of program and a sponsor and the steps and recovery, and it didn't look like that. And here's the other reason I tell you the story, is because on the day that we buried her at Glen Haven Mortuary, which is up on a hill about 5 miles from my house, I'm standing next to this hole in the ground. I'm about to lower this little box in. You don't get a big box when you toot, you get a little box. And they lowered her down into that hole. And I thought to myself, a conscious thought, that any God that would allow this to happen to my child or anybody's child is no God of mine. And in my head, I put God, went right down in the hole with both of them. We threw dirt in the hole, and I never went back. I left her and God up on the hill, and I did not go back. And if you knew me in the intervening years between that and the time I finally got to you guys, you would have never known that I had a daughter. It simply didn't come up in conversation. I don't have the tools to deal with the emotional stuff that happens around that, so it just simply didn't happen. The next time I went to that cemetery was to stand on that little girl's grave with a letter that I crafted for my ninth step that was written with the help of my sponsor to make amends to somebody who's not there to hear it. And I will tell you that it works from my own experience. That amends wasn't done, and I'll get to that in a minute. Leslie and I met on a movie. We were working in Arizona. She was very excited. I'm not going to tell you I'm deep. It occurred to me right away. It took very little time in her presence to figure out that the minute you poured in alcohol, her clothes blew off. They like flew all over the room. And that's not a big foundation for a relationship, but it was good enough for me. I wasn't very deep. And I didn't find out until well into sobriety, she just really didn't like clothes. when she was sober, we'd go to the lake and we'd be back in the boat down the ramp. She'd go, can I take them off now? There's like 500 people launching their boats and going to the marina and stuff. She hated wearing clothes. I had no idea, had nothing to do with the booze. So she, I was married at the time that we met in Arizona, and she wound up, so long story, and I won't bore you with it. I wound up bringing my girlfriend home to meet the wife and kids. I went out to pick her up for a date, and she was drunk and got in a car wreck and basically died in a wreck, died again in the hospital, and had no place to go. So I told him, we're good. I loaded her in my car and took her home. I called my wife on the phone and said, I'm bringing a friend home. Has been in a wreck. Bring your drunk girlfriend home to meet the wife and the kids for the first time. I tell my friends in AA when I traveled around, and we're all going blow for blow on the sickest stuff we ever did. And I tell them a couple of mine, and then I say, I was stone cold sober at the time. And they lose interest in the one up. They go, oh, well, so I was saying, and they go talk to somebody else, because they can't, nobody can match that for that insanity without having been chemically altered. But I did. Drinking never worked for me. I will tell you that for the year that little girl lay in a coma in need of 24-hour-a-day constant care, she had to be fed through a tube in her stomach. She had a trach tube. We had a suction machine to catch that little bubble of snot that she's strangling to death on, and you're trying to catch it, and the heart monitor's going off, and I could not be in the room with my little girl. I would stand at the foot of her crib, and the feelings would come up until they got right to the bottom of my eyeballs, and I've got to go. And I left. And I work in an industry. I retired last year. I worked 47 years in a business where it was really easy to be gone all day. We worked 16, 18, 19, 20-hour days were not unusual. You'd sleep for 3 and go back. It worked for me because I wasn't in the house, because I couldn't be there. For that year that little girl lay in a coma, requiring 24-hour-a-day constant care, that wife did all of her care because I could not do it. I mention that because that resentment I had about my dad, what I understand today because of this process, because I did what you said. I learned about the disease of alcoholism by going to open AA meetings and hearing about a disease I don't have from the people who have it. I understand that my father was no more capable of uttering a word to me when I walked up to that hospital than I was of standing near that little girl's crib. He could not do it. He did not have the tools deal with the emotions any more than I did. We were a family deeply crippled by the disease of alcoholism. My father didn't drink. I never drank. I will tell you that if alcohol did for me what I know it did for her and all of my really good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, if it did even a smidgen of that for me, I'd have just got drunk. I'd have been in that room. I'd have been fine. I'd have just picked up a drink. If a drink would have taken that away and allowed me not to flee my house, I would have drank. Drinking never did that for me. Believe me, I tried. I'm a child of the 60s. We tried a lot more than alcohol, and none of it ever had that perform that function of taking me out of right here, right now. I was always in it. I didn't have anything. There was no buffer between me and the world. Fingers end here, nerves are out here. There's nothing going to take that away. So then I run across her. She had gone down to Texas to work for a while. She got in trouble after about 6 months. That was kind of her MO. And she called and said, can I come back to California? By then, I dissolved that marriage with that wife. And I drove straight down to Houston, Texas with my foster brother and picked her up in a pickup truck and a trailer and drove her home to live happily ever after. Yeehaw! I got to spend the last year and a half of her active drinking with her under my roof. And it was, I didn't understand what was going on. I don't get it. I work in a business where I go away for a week, a day, a month. I'm gone. I come back. I'm excited to see my girl. I come through the door and I never know which one of the 7 dwarves is going to be there today. Is it happy, sleepy, dopey, sneezy? Which one's in there? Usually it was the dragon. I'd come through that. Is that my time? Thanks, man. Usually I come through the door to the dragon, man. I singe my eyebrows off. I just got here. What the hell's going on? What I know today is, because of going to those open AA meetings, is that when I was gone, my wife could drink the way alcoholism required her to drink. My wife's a floor drinker. She'd get pretty drunk, start getting closer to the floor. She'd get closer to the floor in the bathroom. She would pass out and black out in the bathroom. She said, when you woke up in the morning, I don't understand this, but apparently has great utility, that she's laying on the tile and it's cool. And it's a short trip to any of the facilities she might need. And she's a bathroom drinker. She's a floor drinker in the bathroom. And I would come home and she couldn't let me see that. My presence in the house represented an impediment to her getting the medicine she needed to survive in a world that she thought was so hostile that it would kill her. And if you've heard her story, you'll know that she has reason to believe that from her history, even from her family history. I've got no idea what I'm confronted with. She goes off to AA. I'd gone away on location for a couple of weeks, and she'd called. We had a couple of bad phone calls, and she called me up, and I just got done. I just finally got done. I'm not going to do this anymore. We're not married. It's my house. She's going. When I get home, she's going. And I was on my way to home to throw her out. And I walked in the house, and she walked up to me, and she stood. We're still living in the same house. She stood in front of me. I was sitting on the couch, and she said, and this is interesting because I don't remember doing this, but I believe absolutely that it's true. She will tell you that I said to her when we were doing the dance around her alcoholism and I was trying to help her be sober, that I said to her, she asked me, what would you do if I went and got help for my drinking? And I said, if you do that, if you get help from anybody but me, you're out of here. Now, I don't know how to describe anybody more arrogant to you than that. I told her if she went and got any help that wasn't me, she's gone. And I came home from that trip to put her out. And she came in knowing full well she's out of a house. She said, I know you told me that I couldn't get any help, but I could not do this by myself. She had checked herself into an outpatient program and she had about, I don't know, a few days of sobriety. And for some reason, I just put her on top secret probation instead of throwing her out to wait and see. After about 2 weeks in there, she invited me down to the treatment facility for wives' night. It's me and the wives. It's all my wife is like a rose in the thorns with all the guys, and then all the women and me are in the other room and are trying to. We went to the first half of their meeting because I want to know what it is they're saying to her that's working, because she's not drinking, and they must be saying something to her that I missed. And I was sitting the first half of that meeting, and they would say exactly the same crap to her that I was saying to her at home. She couldn't hear it from me. She could hear it from them. She could hear it from people who, by their own admission, had screwed up everything they'd ever touched in their life, would tell her stuff, and she could do it now. Oh, I hated that. And then they took us off for the pitch in the other room. One woman had a black eye. The old man had beat her up that morning. These are my homies, right? And I believe they tried to pitch me for Al-Anon, and I wound up in a very lively argument with the counselor over whether or not alcoholism was a disease. Yeah, that guy. I'm that guy. I'm arguing with the guy over whether alcoholism is a disease. When I left, he had this really tremendous relief on his face when I went out the back door of that thing. I guess I told him. So now she's going off to AA. Year and a half of sobriety it was before I got to Al-Anon. In that year and a half, we could not be in the same room for 5 minutes. We'd work all week. We both still had jobs. I'd get home on Saturday. By Saturday night, she's calling her dad back in Nebraska saying, Daddy, I'm coming home. Daddy's saying, oh, honey, Jack really loves you. You should stay there. And then he'd hang up the phone because he had done his time. He had done his duty on that deal. So she had no place to go. And then she calls her sponsor, Pat. Pat was the meanest woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. Pat was scary. We went to meetings bigger than this, and there'd be people in the room before the meeting, and there's that din in a healthy meeting. You hear that buzz in the room, that buzz of recovery, and the door would open, and Pat would walk in, and a hush would roll over the room. Everybody look around to see what kind of day Pat's having to figure out how the rest of the night was going to go. She was scary sober. People were afraid of her. Not me. I loved that woman because she was mean to my wife. I remember she called Pat every day. She'd get Pat's machine. Pat's at work. Say, Pat, this is Leslie. Didn't drink today. Things are going to be all right if I just get rid of that son of a bitch. Call you tomorrow. That was the message she'd leave on the phone. Pat calls her up and says, oh, honey, we don't make any major decisions in our first year of sobriety, but when they're as sick as you, it's 3 years. We don't tell either one of our sponsors that. It would scare them off. They just run for the hills. So Pat wouldn't let her leave. I love that woman because she was mean to my wife. Leslie decided Pat needed to meet me so that she would give her permission to get rid of me. So she invited Pat over for dinner. I haven't been to any meetings yet, not even AA. And Pat comes over for dinner. We had a nice dinner. I remember a nice dinner. I don't think it was nice for everybody else. And they went off in the kitchen to clean up, and Leslie leaned over to Pat and said, "What do you think?" And Pat said, "Oh, I don't like him either." She said, "But you picked him. You're staying with him." On the second occasion, by which time I had started going to meetings, Pat came over for dinner. And at dinner, Pat looked over at me. It's just the three of us at the table. And Pat said, "I don't think you should have to live like this. I think you should throw her out." My wife's sponsor told me to throw her out. I wasn't done watching her, so she didn't go anywhere, but I didn't. Her sponsor told me to throw her out. Now, one of the most important things that happened in those early days, and this, I get no credit for this, I hadn't been to a meeting, is after a certain amount of sobriety, my wife went, she had a few months, not very long. She went to her sponsor and she said, "I believe I'm ready to do the steps now." And her sponsor said, "Oh, honey, you're so not ready to do the steps. You don't work and play well with others. We're going to go through the traditions first." I have never, in all of my travels and all the people I've encountered in 33 years of coming to meetings and more than 3,000 AA meetings, I've never heard anybody ever say that somebody came to them and said, "I'm ready to work the steps." And they told them, "No, you're not doing that." But that's what she said to my wife. She said, "You don't work and play well with others." The ideas of those traditions began coming into my house when I did not have a name for them. I didn't know what they were. I will tell you that today our house runs on a structure of the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. That basically every decision we make is rooted either in the traditions or in God help us all elements of the concepts of service. If you want to know how that works, here's how it works in a relationship, right? There's but one authority. I think it's me. We're self-supporting. Our common welfare, the conscience of the group. All of these ideas began to come into the house. How do you have a household with two people and have a group conscience? Here's how it looks in my house. We disagree. I tell her my case. She tells me her case, which is deeply flawed. I point out the inconsistencies in her opinion or her observations. And then because I'm the loudest, I'm the strongest, I own the house and I make the money, for the good of the relationship, I override her and do the right thing. The 12 steps of Al-Anon, and I believe of Alcoholics Anonymous, have an interesting function. When I did the 12 steps of Al-Anon, as given to us directly by AA, we changed one word. The one thing that it did for me was to make me right size with me and with God. For the first time in my life, I knew who and what I was. I knew my assets and my defects. I'm right size with me and I'm right size with God. And it ends right there. The application of the 12 traditions in our home for the first time began to make me right size with you, right size with her, right size with the family, right size with the lady with a full shopping cart and the 10 items or less lying at the market, right? Right size with the rest of the world. And here's what happened as a result of that. When we were wrong size, and I'm the mad dad and she's the bad little girl, and this is even well into sobriety, intimacy is not a possibility in that household. Trust isn't there, partnership isn't there, intimacy isn't there. It is not there. And as we began to apply those traditions in our home and become right size, it opened up the doors to levels of partnership, communications, love, intimacy, sex, that had never existed before because we began to be same size. Now, how do you have a group conscience with two people? Trick question. It's up in concept 9. It's an idea that we use at our World Service Conference called substantial unanimity. The way that works is the conference is going to consider a very important issue, and they agree beforehand that unless the vote is unanimous or nearly unanimous, the conference will take no action. Boil that down to two people. if somebody makes a suggestion of something we want to do, she wants to remodel the kitchen, we have a discussion, and I say, well, no, we can't do that. You know, business is tight. We don't have work come down the road. It seems like one of us has veto power, but what we've done is we've agreed to not take an action unless we both agree to take the action. Bill Wilson said of this idea that you need to be very careful how you use it because the shoe will soon be on the other foot. When I say, I got this great business opportunity, this truck I want to buy, this whatever, and she'll say, well, wait a minute. You told me not to do a full shopping trip last week because we didn't have that much money in the bank. How can we buy a new truck when we don't have that? And that playing field began to get to be right size. We were raised by giants in AA and Al-Anon family groups, raised by people that, I'm not going to drop names from up here, but people that changed my life, changed the lives of a lot of folks that showed us how to do this. They would show up at our meetings as couples, as AA and Al-Anon couples, and share about recovery in their house from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. My marriage has recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I told you about what happened when I put my little girl on the ground. The other half of that story is that when I got a lady sponsor is what I had. There was a guy, he had 6 months. I asked him to sponsor me. He'd never done the steps. I need more help. I need more tools than he's got. I don't know what to do. A lady came and talked at a meeting about changing sponsors and said it was okay. I didn't know you could do that. I thought once you pick him, you're stuck with him. It's like a contract, right? Like you're married to him. And I walked up to a woman in my meeting. Her name was Frankie, and I asked Frankie to sponsor me. And I, with a full expectation that Frankie would say, oh, no, honey, I'm sorry, but I don't sponsor no men. If that had happened, I would not be standing here today. What Frankie said is the only correct answer to the question, will you work with me? The answer to that question is, I would be honored to work with you. And that's the only answer I've ever given since that time. I'd be honored to work with you. Now, she is well aware of my problems with the God thing. I'm trying to figure out how to do the steps and weed through the God cones. Just not touch any of the God cones. Get up the top. And she knew that. And we got to the third step. And she invited me to come up to her apartment. And we sat in her little tiny kitchen. And she handed me a yellow legal pad. And she said, I want you to write on that pad what your God looks like. My God killed my little girl to send me a message about what a piece of crap I am. That's what my God looks like. My God gives me pain to learn spiritual lessons. My God judges me no matter what I do or think or say. I'm always coming up on the short end of the stick. I wrote this horrible page of stuff. I got to take God's inventory. It was great. I wrote it all down. And I did not know until sometime after that, that lady, my sponsor, was a glowy-eyed, Bible-banging, born-again Christian woman, deeply involved in her church. If she had ever mentioned even the remotest idea of that in a meeting, I would have never made eye contact with her, let alone asked her to work with me. And to her credit, she never did. And I wrote that page out, and she says, what do you got? And I slid it over, and she read the whole thing. I'm waiting. She gets to the bottom and she goes, oh, your God sucks. And she ripped the page off of the yellow legal pad and wadded God up and threw him clear across the kitchen into the bin, a 3-point shot in the bin. Little rim shot down. When I came out of my chair, I said, whoa, you could do that? She goes, I just did. He's fired for non-performance of his duties. Great. Well, now what do? We just fired God. How do we go? What do we do now? And at that moment, she did something that changed my life. She slid the pad back over and she said, I want you to write on that pad what God would have to look like if you could turn your life over to him without any exception. Absolutely every area of your life, what would that God look like? She'd give me an assignment. I want to pass the class. I want to get an A in the assignment. I want her to like me. I want to be one of you. And I wrote on the top line of it something I heard in an AA meeting. God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And I put the pen on the second line, touching the paper. I could not think of another single word to write on the page. And this is over. I got nothing. I'm failing the assignment. She's never going to return my calls again. Al-Anon didn't work. We're moving on. I had to find something else. And she said, what do you got? And I literally said, I've got nothing. She said, let me see that. I slid the page over to her. And she read it out loud. God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And then she changed my life. She said, that's good enough. That's God. We're moving on. The only thing that I've known for the last 33 plus years about God is he wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And that when I'm not, it's not God. It's my will has resurfaced or the will of somebody else. But it's never God's will that I'm anything other than happy, joyous, and free. And that one I could work with. And it opened that door just a crack. The purpose of the 12 steps, I ask people this all the time. You'd be amazed at the wrong answers that I get. The purpose of the 12 steps is contained in step 12. But just before we'd done that step, I'd gone off to Mexico and I wound up on a week vacation. It was a sober trip with my wife. And a couple of guys named Joe and Charlie, who were famous all over the world for a big book study they did, Big Book Comes Alive, did their study every day for 5 days during the week. I got to sit in, got to meet those guys and got to talk to them and stuff. And he said that the purpose of the 12 steps was stated in step 12. Bill Wilson, he referred to it five different ways, main ways, there were others in the literature, was to have a spiritual experience. Bill got hit by lightning. He had a white light spiritual flash, right? The group said, Bill, you're the only one that did that. We all had a more educational variety, so he softened it to spiritual awakening. And then he went on to describe it three more ways. One was a psychic change. One was a change in personality, which is very interesting. And the last one that he got from Dr. Harry Thibault, who was a non-alcoholic friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, he went on to become a non-alcoholic trustee. Dr. Thibault said that the purpose of the 12 steps was to create a reduction in ego sufficient to allow recovery to occur. A reduction in ego sufficient to allow recovery to occur. What that did for me in those pre-God days was it identified the nature of my disease as rooted in my ego, and the nature of my solution is rooted in humility. And today I expand that in my life, my understanding that my ego is a distance from God. The more I'm in the ego, the farther I am from any idea of any kind of a higher power. And that humility is an action going towards God or conscious contact with God. And today I'm okay to, that might actually be right. Wow. Last month, he like flashed him a half an hour early and said, we're done with you. So with that understanding, that opened the door to that idea. And I'll tell you something just because it's on my mind. You know, I didn't want to, first phone call I ever made, outreach phone call, they said, yeah, I got a problem. You're going to do something stupid. You need to talk to somebody. Use the phone list. It's me and the girls, man. I'm going to call one of these girls on the phone list, right? And I remember the first time I tried, I got the phone, got the list out. I picked a name and I dialed it and it rang the first time. And I thought, you know, I don't remember if she's married. And it rang again. And if she's married, I don't remember if her husband was sober. And it rang again. I said, she's not going to remember me from the meetings. I'm the only guy. I'm showing up at meetings in spandex on my bicycle. They all remembered me, didn't they, Gita? They all remembered me, right? Finally, it rang about the fourth time, and I hear this, hello, and I hung up the phone and ran out of the room because I don't know how to talk to people. If you think that calling somebody, because I get this all the time, I didn't want to call you because I didn't want to bother you. You're very busy. You sponsor a lot of people. You do a lot of service. Is that your ego or is that humility talking? What does it take for you to make the assumption that you can somehow upset the course of my day or inconvenience me? Is that ego or humility? I'm sorry. Pick up the damn phone. We will tell you on the other end if it's not a good time or we'll call you back. Don't let the 500-pound phone be the death of you. I've been to the funerals here. Al-Anon is not some kind of AA light. We've buried a lot of people. Tomorrow I'm going to a funeral for a woman who died of alcoholism, and her husband is one of us from this group. And he's in another program as well. He's got 41 years of sobriety. And he watched her die right in front of his eyes, and he could do nothing to stop it with 41 years of sobriety. When you go to an open AA meeting, they read the 12 steps, and it's followed by three pertinent ideas. And the second one, I've got a big book at home. And in my big book, next to that is a picture of me. It says that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. No matter what I know, no matter what I say, no matter how pretty I sing or how fast I dance, I will never be elevated beyond human power. I've had to experience that with my children. My son went on the street. By then, we were in recovery. We'd made the best amends we could do. We had a recovering household. He needed to go work on his story. He took off at 16. By the time he wound up in Oregon, he had wants and warrants in seven states. He's got a couple of kids now. I've got a couple of grandkids. He can't feed them or house them, and he's struggling because he can't work because his alcoholism has got him. And he finally got a job, and he called me up. He went to Shadron, Nebraska. He was doing line maintenance for the railroad. He got a job. He got his first job in like many years. He's going to be able to feed my grandkids and put a roof over their head. And he called me. He says, "Dad, first night on here on the job," and we went out to the bar to celebrate the new job, and I got in a knife fight, and I'm in jail on two felony counts. And if I don't show up in the morning for that job, I'm going to lose the job. Do you think you can throw my bail? How's that for a little rock and a hard spot, right? I want my grandkids to be able to eat and have a house and have food and have their dad have a job. But I know I can't bail him out. And there's a ton of reasons why. And this is very important. When he said, "Dad, do you think you could bail me out?" My answer was, "I'm sorry, I can't do that." And I stopped talking. I suffer from lack of self-esteem. I don't believe what's in here can make a valid decision. My idea in that circumstance is I tell you my boundary, my decision. I tell you all the reasons why it's the right one. And then you go, "Oh my God, I never thought of it that way. You're absolutely right. I'm going to change everything." So far, that has not happened. Thank you, 5 minutes. So when I explain all the reasons why I think that's the right decision, the party on the other end believes that we are now in a negotiation. And he'll make his case and tell me all the reasons why it would be a good idea for me to bail him out. And then when I don't do it, I don't hear from him. Instead, I said, "I'm sorry, I can't do that." I didn't say, "You're in there because you're an alcoholic. You can't afford it. Your mom would never allow me to do it." There was a whole lot of reasons. I didn't say any of that. He called me every day from jail for 6 weeks about he was going to get him. He's going to get a lawyer. They were all wrong. They had done him wrong. And finally, at the end of 6 weeks, he said, "Dad, I know I'm in here because I'm an alcoholic. And I've got a bigger problem than that. There's no AA in this town." They're in Shadron, Nebraska, in Dawes County, extreme northwest Nebraska. He says, can you help? And I says, "No, but maybe I know somebody," because that's the answer. I can't help you, but maybe I know somebody. I called a guy who was a giant. He sponsored so many people and carried the message all over the world, Dick Martin. And I told him what was going on. My son wants to call an alcoholic. It's got to be a landline, it's collect, and it's expensive. Somebody needs to be able to take his call. You can't call a cell phone. And he said, "I'll get back to you." An hour later, the AA delegate to the state of Nebraska called me up. I never met him before. He said, "I don't know who you are, but Dick told me to call you. What's up?" So I told him. He said, "Here's my phone number. He can call me." I said, "Do you know anybody up in northwest Nebraska? Do you know any AAs up that way?" And he says, "I'm not sure, but I'll look into it." And the next day, two guys with big books took a meeting into a jail that had never had an AA meeting. That was 12 and a half years ago. That's my son's sobriety day. My son is alive and sober today because I did not help him. Now, I'll tell you very quickly because I've only got about three minutes. I've got 3 minutes. I'm watching. I got it back there. And it's not spinning this time. That was scary last week. My wife sponsored a woman, couldn't stay sober. She'd get drunk, get sober, get drunk, get sober. In between each one, she'd have another kid. She had five kids. She dropped one of them on his head when he was 2 months old and he died. What a great reason to keep drinking. And she wound up on the street. We wound up with two of the kids. We just were going to keep him until she got dried out. And it didn't happen. Her common-law husband picked her up to celebrate her new sobriety, took her out for margaritas. And they never came back for those kids. They were 3 and 5, and they were tore up from the floor up by this disease. Now, I will tell you that after the death of my daughter, she was a little brown-haired, brown-eyed girl. Her name was Jessica. That I could not be around kids. I really couldn't be around little kids that had brown eyes and brown hair. I couldn't do it. And these little girls got no place to go. My wife says, I don't know what to do with them. And what I said, and this is not me, this is who I am because I maintain my spiritual condition. I said, why don't you bring them here? I think that we can talk about anything. Why don't you bring them here? And those little girls came to live with us when they're 3 and 5. Mom and dad never come to get them. The little one had severe emotional problems. She's got a laundry list of diagnoses, bipolar 1, that's violent outbreaks requiring hospitalization, ADHD, fetal alcohol syndrome, attachment disorder. There's a list of them. She'd been heavily hospitalized and medicated for years because of drinks she didn't drink and drugs she didn't choose because her mom used when she was carrying her. The wreckage of alcoholism came back into our house. I made that amends to that little girl standing on her grave to the best of my ability all the way in. I did exactly what you guys told me to do, what my sponsor said to do, and it cleaned it up in here. But there were pieces in here that were broken so deep inside that I couldn't reach them. You couldn't reach them. My sponsor couldn't reach them, or God couldn't reach them. Those little girls reached. They're now 26 and about to be 28 years old. The 28-year-old has got somewhere under 2 weeks of sobriety again. She's coming and going in AA. And believe me when I tell you I'm cursed with vision. I understand. I can identify the problem and the solution. My disease says, draw a straight line. Problem, solution, go from here to there. And the problem is I'm right. But I know I can't tell her that she's going to have to get it from you or from somebody else. My little girls, both of them, will tell you that I'm the best daddy on the face of the planet. I didn't know that I could be that. I didn't know that I wanted to be. Today, I'm a good husband married to the woman of my dreams. I've never been happier in my life. We got stuff going on. She's got cancer and a couple of other things. We almost lost her 2 weeks ago. A year and a half ago, we did again. And today, I stand before you, the happiest guy on the planet. We're just doing okay. Loving life, living large, not wasting a single day. I'm madly in love with this woman who I could not stand when I came to you. If I get nothing else from Al-Anon, that was worth the price of admission. Thank you.